The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The following program was pre-recorded, and the views expressed do not necessarily represent those of this station or its management.
We don't need no education. We don't need no thought control.
Get ready to take notes, because school is now in session. Tackling the biggest issues in education, this is Education America. Save the classroom, save the country. Here are your hosts, Headmaster Rebecca Hagstrom and co-host Abigail Johnson.
Hey, teacher, well, welcome to Education America, where we are working to save the classroom so that we can save the country. K-12 education is the playing field where the battle is on for the future of our country. As the 16th President Abraham Lincoln succinctly stated, the philosophy of the schoolroom in one generation will be the philosophy of government in the next. And our listeners may already notice that while normally we are a really fun duo here at Education America, I am running solo with a fantastic guest with us in the studio today. I'd like to welcome Mr. Daniel Buck. Daniel is an editorial and policy associate at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. He's also the author of a book called What is Wrong with Our Schools? And most importantly, he has taught English and English as a second language in middle school and high school levels. And we are so glad to both get his policy expertise and his expertise as a teacher in the classroom. Daniel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
And I did have to, I can't leave off that you are absolutely a prolific tweeter. Our guests are very familiar with my finds on Twitter, mostly because it is so encouraging to find other people who are fighting to correct course in education. And sometimes that does happen on the discourse on Twitter. So some of my favorite tweets of yours was, if your students know your political views, you're doing teaching wrong. And I couldn't hit that like button enough on that one. So thanks so much just for your outspokenness on Twitter and for drawing attention to so many things of, you know, what's going on in the classroom through your writings as well.
Yeah, thank you for that introduction. I've been on other programs before where they skipped all the other stuff and just introduced me as a prolific tutor. So I appreciate that your listeners now know I do other things other than sit on social media and rot my brain all day.
Yes, yes, you can communicate in more than 140 characters, which is very important, actually, in life.
It has taught me a fair amount about writing and how to succinctly make an argument and throw a quick pop shot along with longer, more thoughtful, nuanced analysis.
Well, and let's be really honest. So most of our listeners know in my, you know, younger years, I was in education policy at the political level in the state of Minnesota. And I will say there are many in education who could benefit from being limited in communicating only in 140 characters. I've never seen people who can chat so much as people in education. So which often nuance is very important, but sometimes it's good just to succinctly make your point.
Omit needless words, as Strunk and White said. There's about 5 of your listeners who are going to catch that reference, and I am here for those 5 listeners.
Yes. Well, I really, we kind of chatted before you came on, and I want to just update our listeners. All of the articles that I'm going to reference are, you can find on, if you look up the Fordham Institute and look under Daniel Buck, you'll see these pieces that he's written. And what I love about this show is it gives me the opportunity to really delve into subjects that, frankly, I find interesting and that I see, you know, trends that I see happening across schools in the nation, as well as some things that we are trying to do a little bit differently at Liberty Classical Academy, this school that is my actual day job. And one of the things that we wanted to kind of bring up is that in your article, thinking requires knowledge. That title just caught my attention. It's something that I chat with families about quite a bit. During what we teach at Liberty, we're teaching history. We're going deep into history. And one of the phrases that I use with them is, you know, we have a lot of people, usually on social media, who are expressing views or opinions on, let's say, for example, the Electoral College. However, most of them don't know what the Electoral College is or why it was put into place in the first place. And so one of the things that we chat about with the benefits of a classical education is we actually talk about what that is, why it was there, what is the history, and then you can have an educated discussion on does it currently serve its, you know, past intended purpose or not. But I would love to know a little bit more from your perspective how the education system lacks actual content teaching. How did we get to this place?
Well, my obsession, my almost neurotic obsession with knowledge began over drinks, of all things. A friend of mine who works in the hospital system was saying how, you know, hospitals are looking for nurses that have critical thinking skills. And I tried, and I was like, what does that mean? My friend couldn't quite answer what exactly it meant, critical thinking skills. There's this love in the education sector for the concept of critical thinking skills. It's prized above perhaps anything else. There's this initiative with the Carnegie Foundation and the Education Testing Service, which administers the SAT and GRE, and they want to shift education from a narrow focus on, you know, English literature and historical and scientific knowledge, and instead focus on broader goals like problem-solving skills, collaboration, critical thinking skills. It's so warm and fuzzy, and it appeals to everyone. It spreads because it's easy for politicians to sell. If we're going to teach about slavery versus the Tulsa Race Massacre versus the Holocaust, these are controversial topics and get really icky really quickly. But saying we want to teach our kids to think critically is appealing, and everyone can nod along and go with it, and no one's offended. It's innocuous, but it's also vapid. What gives an engineer an ability to think critically about bridge design? They know a whole lot about physics and math and structural dynamics. I don't even know because I'm not an engineer. I can't think critically about engineering because I don't have content knowledge. Doctors can think critically or problem solve patient cases because they know a lot of science. They know about biology and anatomy and pharmacology and all of these ologies. If I want to teach my students to think even about, you know, modern politics, well, I would hope that they know something about our founding, that they've read our founding documents, that they have historical knowledge about World War I and World War II and the Civil War and why we fought these things and what we fought for and what the results were. If you want to think critically about the present, you have to have a whole lot of knowledge about the past, about science, about literature, about math, you name it. So critical thinking without knowledge, it's like an oasis. It's this appealing thing in the distance, but once you get there, it's substanceless. It's nothing. It needs to be bolstered with facts, honestly.
That's exactly true. And I'll quote one of the facts that you were citing in your article. 2/3 of millennials don't know what Auschwitz was, and only 2/5 of Americans could name all 3 branches of government. 1 in 5 couldn't name a single one of the branches of government. This is something that I see all the time. We have kids coming into our school. Maybe their parents have decided to make a switch from wherever their children were at. And this is what I have to try to help them understand is actually how little actual content their children have been taught, and then helping them understand that it will be a big difference coming into our school because we are very content focused. And I think that just having you say that, it really made so much sense to me. And one of the things that our listeners have heard a lot about is, and you also reference in your article, is The changing of state standards, and Minnesota is currently wrestling through adopting new social studies state standards, and they are replacing requirements for content knowledge with action civics and advocacy projects. And I mean, you called that out so beautifully in that, and you were one of the few people who referenced Paulo Freire, which I was really impressed with. It took me a long time just to even practice saying his name, so, and getting it relatively quick, correctly. So can you just tell us a little bit more about where did this come from with Paulo Freire, and why is it that we're not focusing on content anymore?
Well, I appreciate that you brought up, you know, state level standards and state level curriculum and expectations, because it's a good example of how schools become vacuous and empty of content knowledge. I can't speak to Minnesota standards specifically, but I know in my own state of Wisconsin, our social studies standards, you know, it's dozens of pages of so-called academic skills. Students will be able to analyze a historical document. But if I drop, you know, the Magna Carta or the Declaration or the Constitution or letters between Abraham Lincoln and people that he's arguing with, or the letter from Birmingham Jail in front of my students, but they don't know about the Civil War, they know nothing about British history, they know nothing about the modern civil rights movement, if they don't have a knowledge of that history, they won't actually have this, they won't, it doesn't matter how much skills or so-called skills they have, they won't be able to analyze those documents. They have to know something about history to be able to contextualize those documents and compare the arguments in those documents to ones that have been made before. Where Wisconsin actually outlines standards, it's one page and it says things like the modern era or the modern age. It's just, it's nothing. Youngkin and DeSantis both reformed their state level content and standards in, or their standards in a content direction, and they got media flack for it, and they went through a media maelstrom because, again, it is controversial. If you include a unit on the Holocaust, you will have less time necessarily to learn about something else. You have to pick and choose. And so content is just controversial. Before I get into the Paulo Freire stuff, I just have to say, like, not all of this is some nefarious plotting to indoctrinate children. It's just lazy politicians wanting to avoid controversy and make everyone happy.
Yes.
That is where a lot of it comes from. And also, we have this alternative influence in what I call, or not what I call, what is called critical pedagogy. You reference it comes from Paulo Freire, this Marxist Brazilian education theorist. His book, Pedagogy of the Oppressed, is canon at schools of ed. It is one of the most assigned books to prospective teachers, the teacher prep programs. And his argument, in short, he maps the oppressor-oppressed dichotomy of Marx onto the teacher-student relationship, and suggests that schools should not be formal academic training centers. Teachers have nothing to offer children, no knowledge, no expertise, no habits of right and wrong and proper behavior. They have nothing to offer students, because if they try to do that, they're just assuming this oppressor role. Instead, schools should be places of societal change. They are where the activism to bring in this glorious revolution is going to happen. So in Freire's vision, we basically need to deconstruct everything that came before, throw it out, and make something new. So we have nothing to learn from history. There is no point in reading the classics like Shakespeare, because they are relics of the past, relics of this oppressive Western regime, and we need to spend our time deconstructing them, not handing them along as an inheritance to our students.
And I like that you mentioned that Freire's book is often given out in teacher prep programs. One of the other sources that I was looking through, if people are wondering, why are they talking about this guy from Brazil who is dead? We're talking about him because Freire is recognized as one of the third most cited scholarly author in all of the humanities and social sciences by all authoritative metrics. That means that You can elect all of the school boards you want in your local district. You can be keeping an eye on your child's homework, but these are the things that help shape the person's mind who's teaching your student in the classroom. These are the things that are offered to teachers while admittedly they're still in training. So they don't have a firm idea of what does it look like for me to be a teacher. They're still in that training time. And this is one of the authoritative works that is most given out to help them understand how to teach students. And I don't know if you were listening to Mr. Buck there, but he's saying that it's showing them they don't have a whole lot to teach students, actually, except to tear down whatever it is that they're talking about for the day.
Yeah, and the key thing about Frary is he's not suggesting that we need to basically train students to be activists in the future, because that's still just assuming this old teacher-student-oppressor-oppressed relationship. No, no, no. Our job is to be co-learners and co-advocates with the students and encourage them into advocacy right now. Teach them to go to the streets and petition the legislature and topple statues and march down hallways, everything that we see on social media and the news right now all traces back to Frary. And like you said, he's kind of this just unknown figure in the, at the dinner table, even though he's one of the most cited, one of the most read, one of the most revered education thinkers there is. He's one of the most influential philosophers of education, and yet so few people have heard of him. And it has been one of my goals to just get his name out there. If I can hold up his book on Fox News, I will have succeeded. I haven't yet, but gosh darn it, I've talked about him on Fox.
I love it. And really, I mean, if you're a parent listening to this, I mean, I'm laughing to myself because I have little kids. The last thing I want is for an adult in their life to gin them up and get them more hyped up than they naturally are about something that they don't know anything about. We want to grow students. We want to grow children into, again, people who can think critically and use rationality and facts and data and logic to then think about how do I be a positive change in the world? Absolutely. But you don't want 10-year-olds running around questioning authority, because to be very frank, 10-year-olds don't know anything.
Can I cut in with a brief story?
Yeah.
There is this phenomenal video of Dianne Feinstein, God rest her soul, being just yes. absolutely based. There's a group of children, ranging from 8 through high school, who accost her in the hallway, presumably with their teacher, and this was planned as a class activity, and tell her that she needs to vote some way on some bill. And she just dresses them down, and it is kind of delightful to watch her puncture their youthful, honestly, arrogance, presumptuousness. When she says, do you understand how bills are made? Do you understand how much money is in the budget? Do you understand even how I was elected or by what kind of majority I was elected by? No, you don't. I will go and make the laws like I was elected to do with the knowledge that I have, and you should go back to school and learn how to do these things and learn how our system of government works so you can take on that role when you are adults. And this Frarian model of education is perfectly exemplified in this moment when you have these children completely devoid of knowledge and yet filled with passion. They're filled with righteous anger, but they have no clue what they're fighting for, what their vision of a better world is. So what's the only thing they can do? They can only tear down. They can only smash windows. They can only topple statues, and they can never build something better in its stead. And it's a dark irony of Frarian educational philosophy that this utopian philosophy kind of results only in destruction.
Yes. So basically, Frary produces a whole bunch of Greta Thunbergs.
And, precisely.
And if you exactly all don't know who that is, go look it up, because it is, I mean, again, it's hilarious.
This God part. Bless you. Stay ignorant.
Please. Oh, my gosh. I mean, although, to be fair, she's an adult now. So I feel like she's fair play to go ahead and criticize now, because she is now no longer a petulant child being, you know, scolding the adults in the room used to be moderately sort of, I don't want to say cute, but at least you understood she was a puppet for her parents. But now she's a grown up. So she's
just another adult acting like a child is what you're telling me.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Let's go. All right. So this is the clip that Daniel is talking about here. Diane Feinstein. Yeah.
We are trying to ask you to vote yes on the Green New Deal.
Dad, please.
Okay. I'll tell you what. We have our own Green New Deal piece of legislation.
Well, we're trying to promote the Green New Deal.
Well, there are reasons why I can't. Because there's no way to pay for it.
Yes, there is.
We have tons of money going to the military. Half of a lot of us going to the military.
But we have come to a point where our Earth is dying, literally. And it is going to be a pricey and ambitious plan that is needed to deal with the magnitude of that issue. And so we're here asking you to vote yes on the resolution for the Green New Deal because that is the only thing
that resolution will not pass the Senate. And you can take that back to whoever sent you here.
Some scientists have said that we have 12.
Yeah, so there we go. We're having someone actually teach facts and content to young children. So hopefully they got their money's worth out of that trip to Senator Feinstein's office. Well, as we move on from that, I will be honest. I have other questions for you just because there are a number of articles you wrote that I thought were phenomenal. But you had a critique in your articles that I thought, you know, this is really interesting. You have a critique of the phrase, we should teach students how to think, not what to think. You do not, Daniel, fully agree with that statement. And I would love to delve into why just a little bit.
Yeah, so again, this is one of those nice-sounding platitudes that gets administrator a nice polite round of applause or a politician or a talking head nods of agreement. We want to teach students how to think, not what to think. But as I hope I made clear in my rant before, learning how to think begins with learning what to think. You can't think about nothing. Nothing comes from nothing. So if I want to teach my students how to think about something like, impeachment, well, I might read some Federalist Papers with them. I might read the pertaining sections from the Constitution with them. I might read about impeachments from the past and if they succeeded or if they failed or what were the political consequences of these things. Teaching students how to think begins with giving them knowledge, giving them facts, giving them anecdotes from history, giving them the best arguments that have been made in history about political science and philosophy and the nature of right and wrong and the human condition so that they can kind of imbibe them, make those ideas their own, and then think critically. I can't think critically. Heck, I can't even read a passage about the sport cricket because I don't know anything about it. If I want to think critically about cricket, I need to first learn what in the world cricket is, what the rules are, what the words are, what the teams are, how it's scored, all of these kinds of things. Learning how to think about that topic begins with learning what that topic is, learning something concrete and factual about that topic.
Yes, absolutely. And I love that because honestly, I am guilty of even using that phrase as I have been talking about with different people about education. And I thought, honestly, that really, it made me think about that's very true. However, as I will point out for our listeners within the classical model, we do spend many years just teaching facts and content to our young students before we move into developing their critical thinking skills. Because again, now they have that basis of knowledge built up in them of they know some history, they know some math, they know how to read very well. And now we can begin to develop in them the ability to think critically about these topics, again, within each, you know, isolated academic sphere. You wrote another article about memorization that I kind of wanted to switch from thinking critically, learning content, but how to learn content. And again, I just thought your perspective was really fascinating because in the article, For the Love of Memorization, you actually make a fantastic case for why memorizing is really important for learning. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. If I'm not mistaken, I go on one of my neurotic obsession rants about the importance of knowledge in that. So there's the whole, you know, factual memorization. We want kids to know some basic facts so they understand the space between the Civil War and the World Wars, and can contextualize the, you know, historical knowledge that they're learning. But I also talk about just things like memorizing poetry. It's something that I had my students do every single year. They had to memorize a poem. They had to memorize passages from Romeo and Juliet. And they were always disgruntled, and they thought it was dumb when they first experienced it. And then I'd go outside and watch them for recess. And I remember one year, there was a girl who was kind of on the fringes of the social groups. She didn't really have, wasn't really in with any of the crowds. And would sometimes at recess just kind of walk around by herself or sit with herself on the strings. But all of a sudden, there was a four-square game. And all the girls that were playing four-square were working on the same poem. It was something by Emily Dickinson. I don't remember precisely what it was. The bird came down the wall, I think. He did not know I saw. He bit an angleworm in half and ate the fellow raw. Emily Dickinson. And this girl was memorizing the same one. And suddenly she had something in common with this group of friends. And it gave her an in with them. It gave her, C.S. Lewis says that all friendship begins with the phrase, what? You too. I thought I was the only one. You also love Lord of the Rings? I love Lord of the Rings. We have something in common now. And these girls had this moment of you too. And suddenly this social outcast was part of the in-group because she shared culture. Our public schools are one of the few remaining, or should be one of the few remaining communal institutions that we have. And even if not public schools, you know, our good church, classical, Catholic schools, they're these communal institutions. And our country is going to continue to fray unless we build a common culture and sharing a love of famous passages, beautiful poems, that's going to bring us together. At the end of the year, you know, I'd have students come back to me and they'd poke their head in the door at the end of the year. They'd graduated, they're coming back, visiting me from their, you know, benighted high schools and go, Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo? Deny thy father, refuse thy name. They still loved it. They loved these poems. And it was something that they brought with them and cherished, like this little like a card from a grandmother or something, or a family heirloom. It's just this little lovable memory that they have in their head for the rest of their lives.
And I love hearing that. We think of memorization as dry, but instead it really brings so much feeling and connectivity and community. Well, listeners, we are nearing the end of our time with Daniel Buck for this interview today. I hope that you've enjoyed it and learned a little bit more about why we need content and even why memorization can be a really great thing. You can check out Education America on anywhere where you listen to podcasts, Spotify, iTunes, and please check us out also on 1280 AM, The Patriot. Have a great night, everyone.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.